Je commence par dire que c'est un grand plaisir d'avoir Mathias avec nous, même si c'est de manière virtuelle. C'est beaucoup mieux que rien, voilà. Donc on est très content que tu sois là. Je présente Mathias en deux mots pour ceux qui ne le connaîtraient pas. Mathias a fait sa thèse avec Ted Hensch entre 92 et 95. Et avant ça, il avait passé deux ans à l'école normale, au LKB, dans le groupe de Michel Brune, Serge Haroche, Jean-Michel Raymond. Et ensuite, après sa thèse, il a fait un postdoc avec Jörg Walraven à Amsterdam. Tout ça, c'était sur les thèmes du laser cooling. Il y avait des réseaux optiques, il y avait du subrecoil, du refroidissement subrecul. C'était les grands moments du refroidissement laser. Ensuite, il est allé à Heidelberg. Alors, il était à Heidelberg en même temps que Rudi Grimm. Ils faisaient une paire vraiment remarquable, tous les deux, je me souviens. Ils étaient pas dans un institut d'optique quantique, c'était le Max Planck für Kernphysik, si je me souviens bien, c'est la physique nucléaire, mais néanmoins, ils faisaient des atomes froids au milieu des physiciens nucléaires. Et puis ensuite, donc, Mathias a pris une chaire à Freiburg pendant 5 ou 6 ans, jusqu'en 2008. Mais l'attrait de Heidelberg était trop fort. Il est revenu à Heidelberg, cette fois-ci avec un poste de full professeur à l'université d'Heidelberg. Il a aussi travaillé à temps partiel en Chine pendant de nombreuses années, à Haifa. Alors, Mathias a vraiment beaucoup de domaines d'expertise, donc je ne vais pas les résumer, je ne vais pas les donner tous, hein, mais un de ses travaux qui est vraiment très célèbre, c'est les travaux sur la few body physics, c'est la physique à peu de nombre de corps. C'est en particulier lui qui a vu le premier de ces états d'Efimov avec un grand rapport de masse entre les deux constituants. C'était son système favori, c'est lithium et césium. Donc il avait deux atomes de césium lourds qui étaient liés par un atome de lithium léger. Et il a vu comme ça, je crois, jusqu'à trois résonances d'Efimov successives et mis en évidence cette invariance d'échelle propre à Efimov. Une autre chose pour laquelle Mathias est très fameux, c'est la physique moléculaire. Il avait su préparer un gaz de molécules dipolaires dans l'état aérovibrationnel. Là encore, c'était lithium-césium. Et puis, il a son activité qui est vraiment impressionnante sur tous les états de Rydberg, toute la physique des états de Rydberg. Rien qu'en 2021, il y a eu à la fois un papier dans Science, un papier dans PRX sur cette dynamique collective d'états de Rydberg. Et c'est justement de ça qu'il va nous parler aujourd'hui, en nous expliquant comment est-ce que ces états de Rydberg peuvent faire de vrais simulateurs quantiques. Voilà, donc je suis vraiment très content de lui laisser la parole. Et puis, la discussion, c'est vraiment une discussion comme s'il était avec nous. N'hésitez pas à poser des questions à la fin, c'est pareil. Voilà, Mathias, à toi.
Jean, merci beaucoup, Atul, et bienvenue. I'm really sad that I couldn't come to Paris in person due to a COVID infection that I had last week, but everything is fine again. I've been the first time in the Collège de France, I remember more than 30 years ago. That was when Claude Contarnougi gave his famous classes on laser cooling in another lecture hall at that time. And I also remember I've been in this lecture hall not so long ago when Serge gave his cours. So it's great. Next time I will come in person and enjoy the hospitality in Paris and enjoy the memories. So what I would like to talk about today is some really very recent experiments and insights that we gained. And part of this work is not even fully understood and published, but yet I think it's a good audience here to share this and to enter discussion. So the question is a very fundamental one. It is about if I take a system and I isolate it from its environment, under which circumstances this system does it actually thermalize? And as you can see from the subtitle, we have done some experiments recently using a highly excited Rydberg atoms to explore this question, and we have stumbled into some really interesting phenomena, which came as surprises to us, and we are now slowly starting to understand what's going on. Okay, so let's start to introduce the system that we are considering here. So what we are talking about here is a system of spins. So this fits nicely to the lecture of Jean, because Jean was talking about spin systems in Bose-Einstein condensates and the role of spin there. Here we are talking now about just a gas of spins. Just assume here some little dipoles flying around Or in a better case, in our case, let them be frozen on a disordered, in some kind of disordered structure. So these little dipoles, they can interact by some interaction. In our case, that can either be a van der Waals interaction, as it's shown here, so a 1 over R6 interaction between these spins, but we can also set situations where this interaction is of dipolar nature, 1 over R3. And then what we do is we take the system, we prepare it in some state, let's say a state where all the spins are pointing in a certain given direction, and then we suddenly switch a field on that creates a non-equilibrium situation. And this transverse field here, I'm calling omega here. This is the field strength of this field that we are applying. And now the question is, when we do this, the system will somehow evolve. It's an isolated system. We isolate it from its environment as good as we can do. It follows its unitary evolution if it's a quantum system. And then the question is, what is the steady state that is finally being reached by the system? And a more fundamental question even, does the system reach something that looks like a thermal equilibrium? And it's amazing. I mean, this question on how systems reach equilibrium and whether these equilibria are thermal or non-thermal, this is really a question that is bothering physicists since, I would say, since Boltzmann, since the early days of statistical mechanics, when it comes to non-equilibrium physics. And it's even more virulent, this question, since quantum systems or the quantum mechanics came into the game. And still, although quantum mechanics is now more than 100 years old, we still don't have a complete picture on why a system that emerges along a unitary dynamics that is reversible and so forth may, for some local variables, reach a state that looks like a thermal state that can be assigned temperature. And what I will show to you is here a system that somehow provides some new insights into this problem. At least that's what we figured. And as I said, we stumbled upon this more by accident because we were studying these spin systems and their dynamics. And it turned out that this has some very deep relation to this question of how do systems reach equilibrium and whether these equilibria are actually thermal or non-thermal. All right, so let me give you a little bit of an introduction into thermalization. So if you go to classical systems, then the common notion is that if I have a system that's sufficiently ergodic, for example, by having sufficiently nonlinear interactions or things like that, that this system explores the entire phase space eventually. And we keep the energy fixed, so we use something that would use a microcanonical ensemble. And if the system is well behaved, after a while, the entire phase space has been covered at a fixed energy. And then there is this notion of what people now call typicality, and that is what we typically see when we, for example, take a gas container and let it inflate into a larger volume. After some while, this gas will fill out the entire volume, and this is shown here as this distribution here, or these microstates that are filling now the entire volume, and there's only very, very few microstates that are having a negligible probability to being actually populated or realized. That's where the entire gas would be in one corner of the chamber or in another corner. So what we all encounter in nature is that the gas will actually distribute evenly over this entire space, phase space that's available, given the constraints of a certain energy, a certain number of particles that I have, and maybe other constraints, a volume or so that I'm fixing here. So, and then what we also know from statistical physics is if I take now a macroscopic ensemble, here is my spins again with their interactions, then after a while, even if I align them all in the same direction, they will eventually form these kind of microstates where they are all disordered. The magnetization of this entire spin system will be zero. And it doesn't matter then what kind of micro configuration I have from all important macroscopic observables, or if I look at anything that is of relevance for me as somebody looking at the system looks the same. And then I can assign something like entropy and energy, and I can assign something that one would call a temperature. So that is how we typically approach this thermalization problem in classical physics. So as I said, in quantum physics, it's a little bit more complicated because we know that the Schrödinger equation is a linear equation. If I take an observable A here and I take a many-body state psi, then I can just expand this here in the expectation values for energy for energy states here in this operator. And then I can easily write down what the evolution is that gives me just this energy exponent here in the exponential function. So this is a linear equation. So quantum mechanically, we have nothing like classical chaos, although people are discussing what is the relation between classical chaos and quantum systems. Nevertheless, it's a linear equation. And what we can maybe safely assume that these coherences, if the system is not having too many constants of motion, that all these coherences will eventually dephase and the system will equilibrate after a while. So what we end up then after some time is a system where these observables form something like a diagonal ensemble. That means the system emerges into a state where these observables have acquired their eigenstate expectation values for fixed by this initial condition. So that would still mean that my final state would have a memory, a very detailed memory of the initial state, because these expectation values, they depend on what kind of wave function I started with. We know that in thermal ensembles, we forget, for thermal states, everything is forgotten about the initial state. And the question is whether quantum systems also emerge into this. Sometimes people say that the entire world is just one isolated quantum system, but everywhere we find some kind of equilibration. So the question is, how does that actually then come about? And here, one approach is to say, okay, I'm not looking at the entire system, although this entire system might be isolated in following this equilibration here. I might look into subsystems of this larger system. So I make a distinction between a local observable and a subsystem in which this local observable acts and the rest, such that this entire large many-body system acts as its own reservoir, if you want, to a certain extent. And then we can actually happen that these different microstates might have eventually all of them more or less the same density matrix as in the subsystem, that would then be something that we would call a microcanonical expectation value for this density matrix. So in this sense, there's a different form of equilibration here at work. That's an equilibration where the microscopic or sub-ensembles actually equilibrate. I try to picture this here by saying, okay, here, this is my spin system again with all these spins pointing in some direction, and even the individual subsystems down to the individual spin undergo some transition into a state that might look somehow thermal. So now the question is, under which conditions does it actually look thermal? And there is this now, meanwhile, famous eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, which says the following. I mean, if I take here now these expectation values for these observables, and I look at them as a function of the energy that I have, in general, they are smooth functions, as it turns out, for many of the systems that people are considering. And if I now take my eigenstate, if I now take my initial state, then also typically these initial states in many body systems will somehow be pretty localized in around a given energy. If the system is not integrable. So if there's not too many preserved quantities, which might otherwise distribute here in form of a discrete spectrum over this this dimension here. So this is a energy localized situation that we encounter in many systems. And if I take this now and I look at these expectation values here for these observables, then, and this is the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, eventually I can't distinguish between a diagonal ensemble where these where all these different contributions have just phased, all the coherences have just phased away or interfered away, and we are left with this diagonal ensemble, and an ensemble that is actually given by just one expectation value for the for these observables, which no longer depends on the details of the initial state, and that follows this expression for the microcanonical ensemble, where we just take the sum over all these expectation values over a small energy interval, and we just divide by the number of states within this energy interval. So that is what people call the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. At this moment, I have a microcanonical ensemble description for these local observables, and I can no longer distinguish different states from their past, if you want. All the initial everything that describes this initial state here, these coefficients, has actually been washed away. It's no longer relevant. So that is the this framework, and there has been now more and more theoretical studies along these lines. This is a famous first, maybe not first paper, but a famous paper here by Rigol, Dumko, and Olshani from 2008, where they showed that there are for certain systems, bosons, hardcore bosons in this case, these systems actually tend to thermalize. And there is also some beautiful experiments. I just named here three of them using isolated quantum systems, mostly of few particles, 6 to 10 particles, where situations are created in such a way that one can follow the local entropy, the entanglement entropy, and can show that this buildup of entanglement entropy actually is exactly then finally what compensates for the increase of the local entropy of the system approaching this thermal state in this notion of this eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. So there is now evidence that many, many systems, non-integrable systems, actually seem to, quantum systems, isolated quantum systems, seem to thermalize. All right, if they are well-behaved enough. Okay, so that was... somehow, not our starting point, but that was the context that we finally realized that our experiments got into. And I'm going to show to you now what we actually did. And in order to do that, I will first introduce you into Rydberg atoms and how you can use them as quantum simulators for such Heisenberg spin systems. It's not obvious what Rydberg atoms should have to do with Heisenberg systems, spins of magnetic moments. And then I show you a first surprise that we found experimentally, that these systems seem to relax independent of their microscopic initial conditions. And then came the second surprise that we found an interesting, if you want, way to address the question of thermalization without measuring local quantities, but by just looking at the most simple thing that you can do, and that is the total magnetization of this spin system. Okay, let me introduce you into Rydberg atoms. I mean, you probably all know, if we take atoms and we excite them electronically to highly excited states, then they all look like hydrogen, states that are having quantum numbers of 10 or higher. And there's this famous Rydberg formula here, which gives you the relation between the energy of these excited states here and the Rydberg constant. And there is this 1 over n squared, the principal quantum number squared dependence from quantum mechanics, and there's this additional quantum defect that takes into consideration that these electrons are actually, for low angular momentum, penetrating the core, and therefore you see a deviation from the pure Coulomb potential as you would have in hydrogen. But for us and for all the experiments that we are doing here, any atom is as good as hydrogen. So you just need to know the quantum defect, and then you have a simple system that you can study. What is amazing is, I mean, everything started already here 150 years ago. This is a paper from 1879, just a little bit of a historical detour here. This is measurements that people did here on sodium in lime crucibles and potassium here. And you can see that they already figured at that time that there's some that there's some regulation or there's some regular structure in the spectra. And that's probably also, you all know that in the late 19th century, it was Rydberg who actually realized that you can describe all these frequencies by this simple formula. And he already introduced something that we would now call this quantum defect. What is also interesting from these measurements of Rydberg states comes these angular momentum attributions that we have, like SPDF, because these line series were called principal, sharp, diffuse, and fundamental. That's why we have this funny notion of the angular momentum assigned as SPDF and so forth. So it was an amazing discovery because Rydberg figured that this constant here is a universal constant. It doesn't depend on the element that you have at hand. And that later led to one of the first victories of modern quantum mechanics here, this Bohr formula that was able to derive this Rydberg constant on the basis of just fundamental constants, including, of course, Planck's constant here, h bar. So that was an amazing discovery. Since then, these Rydberg atoms are interesting beasts to study. One reason is that they are forming a nice link between the classical world and the quantum world. If you just take the charge density and the probability of finding the charge in a classical Coulomb problem here for an electron going around a proton, then this follows closely the quantum mechanical solution, in particular when you go to high principal quantum numbers here. This is n equals 100, so the typical distance then can be 20,000 Bohr or 10,000 angstroms. And still, this charge distribution, if we forget about these oscillations here, the quantum mechanical oscillation of this wave function follows closely the classical prediction that you would expect. This I took from Serge's Cour at 2013. This is just to give you an idea of the dimensions. This is for n equals 30. This would be DNA. A DNA molecule, this would be here, this little dot here, I don't know whether you can see that, is the hydrogen atom, and this would be here the tobacco mosaic virus. So these electron wave functions, they extend over dimensions that are as large as viruses, or even larger. This is the world record here. People have excited Rydberg states up to 600, where the orbital radius is 20 micrometers, so as large as a hair. So the reason why we are so interested in these Rydberg atoms in the last decade, I would say, is it's not only that they have interesting atomic properties, but they are also interacting in a very interesting and very strong way. What you have is if you take two neutral atoms in Rydberg states, you get a van der Waals interaction that scales as the 11th power of the principal quantum number. So that means we all know that if you take two neutral atoms in the ground state, the interactions at distances of a micrometer or so can be safely forgotten because they are much too small, these van der Waals interactions. But if I excite them to n equals 20 or 30, I get a scaling of many, many orders of magnitude of the interaction, so that even over distances of micrometers, this becomes significant. So this is shown here. This is distances in micrometers. This is interactions being presented in a units of hertz. And you can see that the van der Waals interaction of ground state atoms, you can totally forget here for ground state atoms. But once you excite them here to these Rydberg states, the interaction energies get of the order of megahertzes or even gigahertzes. And the only system that is more strongly interacting is, of course, Coulomb systems, where you remove the charge altogether. So that is, for us, an important feature. And now what you can do is you can think about, okay, can I use these interesting interaction features for something to study general quantum systems in the framework of quantum simulation? And one way to do it is, for example, example, you can use these long-range van der Waals interactions or these van der Waals interactions that extend over micrometers to realize an easing model, because what you have is the ground state amps, they don't interact. Here, the excited states, they interact via the 1 over R6 interaction. And I can just map this then on an easing model where there is a C6 over R6 interaction between the system of this for this pseudo spin, where I take the ground state as the spin down and the excited state as the spin up. There's another interesting feature here that comes about, and it is called the excitation blockade. If I try to excite these states now, these Rydberg states here with optical fields, there is this interaction between these two Rydberg states that shifts my laser out of resonance. And that means that if the two atoms are too close to each other, I can deterministically only excite one atom in a given volume, in a given radius, or which is called the blockade radius. And for us, that is interesting, that because we use that to determine the degree of disorder in our system. So what we do is we excite these Rydberg states. If we excite them on resonance and we have the density low, then these atoms will just be randomly excited in our gas, and we get a distribution function of the distances that has a certain width. But if I now go higher and higher in density, eventually I will get into this blockade regime where the distance between the atoms is actually centered around this blockade radius. And there's only a very small distribution of distances around this blockade radius. So this blockade here allows us to prepare a gas of spins with a varying degree of disorder. So either having a large distribution around a certain central value or having a distribution that eventually has only one distance between two atoms, essentially, or pair distance. I mean, this mapping on the easing model that has been used now in numerous experiments. I'm just showing here beautiful experiments by Antoine Boys at Institut d'Optique, where they used individual atoms being positioned, for example, in such racetrack patterns. And then they indeed studied simulations of this easing model looking at correlation functions that are hard to predict by full quantum calculations. And you can use now these systems to simulate interesting easing models in equilibrium or beyond equilibrium. There's also other groups that are doing this. Meanwhile, there's more and more groups using these optical tweezers to position the Rydberg atoms wherever you want, and then studying quantum mechanical models to as quantum simulators. So what we figured is that these are also very nice systems to study Heisenberg models. That is by using the following. I mean, in our case, we don't use the ground state and the excited state as the pseudo spin, but we use two Rydberg states. If these two Rydberg states have different parity, like here an S state and a P state, we can couple them by a microwave field. And if you look at it now in this language of Heisenberg models, that would be an XX model. So what you would have is a dipolar flip-flop interaction for these two spins, which would then lead to an interaction that it has this term where this delta here would be zero. If you use a two-photon transition between two states with Rydberg states with the same parity, it turns out you get an XXZ model with this delta term here, which is this Z interaction that is negative and has, for the experiments we are doing, 0.7, but you can tune this value by just choosing different N values. And what we also recently figured and used is that you can, if you take states that are having large differences in N, you can map them again onto an easing model, essentially. So what is great about it is now you have a spin system that you can tune, and not only can you tune the interaction strength of these particles, but you can also tune the nature of its interactions in terms of swapping between different models that you would like to investigate. So that's how it looks in the lab. Okay, can't see much, but it's a nice, comparatively simple experiment if you compare it to other experiments that we are having here. And there is a detector here that allows us to trap the atoms and then excite them, ionize them, and state-dependently ionize them such that we can distinguish the different states. So we have a state detective ion detection, which allows us to separate between the different Rydberg states. And in this way, we can map out, if you want, the populations of the two spin states. And what is important here too is that we needed to implement a microwave. Here is this microwave horn that now gets the microwave into the chamber. We use a special optical, microwave optics to focus it into the chamber to have large coupling frequencies. And we can achieve typical Rabi frequencies between these Rydberg states. And that's another great thing about Rydberg states. They have such big dipoles that the typical coupling of this microwave is of the order of nanoseconds. So we can manipulate this system on a, let's say, 1 to 10 nanosecond timescale. Okay, and having done all this, we started to investigate, and this is now really, if you want, conceptually simple experiments. We just take a gas from the shelf, it's frozen spins. We prepare them in a state, then we swap the state in the x direction, and we let it evolve under the action of this coupling here, 1/R6 coupling. So how do we do this? We prepare all these spins, typically it's 3,000 atoms. We go into the state where all the atoms are in one given Rydberg state. That's what we call our down state here, in our case 48S. We use this microwave to prepare the state such that it's no longer a state that points, no, I should be in the room. So that's no longer a state that points downwards, but now we use a state that points in the X direction. And as I said, we just let it evolve. And as it turns out, for this system that we prepared, it's an XXZ Hamiltonian. Okay, and then what we do is we do a tomographic measurement at the end to map out the different components of the Bloch, on the Bloch sphere for the total magnetization of the state. So all the measurements we are doing is global measurements. We have no access so far to local variables as people have in these single ion or single atom experiments having 10 particles. So what we do is we measure the most simple thing, just the total magnetization, as you would also do for any kind of dipolar gas or any kind of solid state sample. Okay, so that's what we do. And that's what we see. So the Hamiltonian is this XXZ Hamiltonian for the states that we chose. And let's first look at this Hamiltonian here in terms of what we would expect for a mean field. In a mean field for this initial state in the X direction, these terms would vanish. And I would be left with a state that is an eigenstate for the mean field. So in all the atoms are in the same direction. They form their own field and they just precess around the field that is formed by all their neighbors. So in other words, what you would expect for the magnetization or the total spin of the system, it would actually just stay more or less constant. There is a little deviation from being perfectly constant, and that is because we don't prepare the state perfectly in this X direction. There's a small additional admixture due to the quantum nature of these microscopic spins. Okay, that's what you would expect from a mean field. What we actually measure is that this spin, that this system actually relaxes. And it relaxes to a finite steady state. And why does it relax? It relaxes essentially because we get correlations that slowly build up in the system. So we start with a state where all these individual spins are pointing in one direction. Now through the interaction, there is correlations being built up and entanglement. And this entanglement eventually leads to a dephasing of all these spins, and finally the system emerges into a state that has vanishing magnetization. What we can do is we can compare measurements to some, if you want, simulations using the so-called truncated Wigman approximation. What you do in the truncated Wigman approximation is that you start with a certain quantum state, including all the different variances of your spins due to the quantum nature of the spins, but then you let the system further evolve classically. So in other words, this truncated Wigman approximation doesn't capture all the buildup of entanglement that you have in the system, but interestingly, it is sufficient for this one-point function for the magnetization to capture the essential dynamics of the system for these different spin components. So that was, when we saw that, we already looked up some literature, and we figured that this system looks very similar to what people know as spin glasses. In spin glasses, what people know is that also in spin glasses, when you excite or when you have a certain magnetization in such a spin glass here for this solid state system, where the spins are embedded in a matrix, in a glassy matrix, then there is this very, very slow demagnetization or dephasing of the magnetization in these spin glasses. Where if you look at this is here a logarithmic time scale and the linear magnetization, you can see that this is a very, very slow development. And it turns out that there's a nice heuristic function that you can use to describe this decay, and that is the so-called stretched exponential function. And you can already see from our data, I mean, this is not exponential decays that we find. It also looks like something that is sub-exponential or even following this kind of simple phenomenological function. And this is a nice function because it has this parameter beta, which you can tune. If it's one, it's an exponential decay. If it's zero, it's a logarithmic decay. And then there's anything in between. And indeed, this stretched exponential function heuristically gives a very, very nice way to just, if you want, fit our data. So now it came the first for us surprise that we encountered. What we did now is we looked at these decays here. We looked at these dephasing of the magnetization as a function of time. And we looked at now onto it for different initial conditions. And what we changed is what I already referred to earlier. What we changed was the degree of disorder. So we changed the density in such a way that we started with a state where we had no influence of the blockade whatsoever, to a situation where the blockade already mattered and we had a distribution, pair distribution function that was centered around a certain value. And if you now look at this in terms of how these what the distribution function of these interactions is, then you can see that there's a certain cutoff in the interactions due to this blockade, because the particles can't get closer to each other than a certain distance, minimum distance, and therefore the interactions are cut off, larger values are actually cut off. And you can see now, as for different disorder or different influence of this blockade in the initial preparation, these distributions look very different, in particular due to this cutoff. Here you can also see this little cutoff for the, let's say, not so strongly interacting system. But interestingly, no matter how we prepare the system, we could make all these dephasing curves or demagnetization curves, we could make them all collapse onto one universal curve by just scaling the C6 coefficient by the typical distance that is encountered in the system. So somehow, the nature of this dephasing, of this demagnetization, does not depend sensitively on the initial conditions. That was a surprise. It turned out that we also found this when we were doing the semi-classical truncated Wigner approximation simulations. So this is already captured in this kind of semi-classical theory, that this magnetization dynamics actually follows something like a, I don't know whether I should call it universal, but some kind of general robust function that is no longer depending on the initial conditions. And it turns out that this holds as long as the system is sufficiently disordered. We get some stretched exponent for the stretched exponential of 0.36. We can rescale the relaxation rates, and typical amplitude is also always the same. Whereas if the system is disordered, these parameters would actually depend on the microscopic details. So we went even one step further and looked at it for different Hamiltonians. So by now making use of the fact that we can implement different Hamiltonians in our system, and also for these different Hamiltonians now changing this delta here, turns out that the predictions, that the calculations predict that they also should all fall onto some kind of universal curve. And that's what we find. This is very recent experiments that we haven't even published. You can see here, this is for an Heisenberg XX, that's for an Heisenberg XXZ, and that's for an easing model. And you can see that all these magnetizations as a function of the scale time, they all fall onto the same curve that can be nicely fitted by a stretched exponential. So no matter whether I have an XX model, XXZ, or an easing model. Meanwhile, we have found also some kind of analytical solution, in particular for the easing model, and we compared this to other systems which people studied where stretched exponential decays emerge. And it turns out that in most of these studies, or in all of these studies so far, these systems were systems that were somehow coupled to a classical bath, and that these stretched exponential functions then come about due to the emergence of different strengths of couplings to this bath, and therefore different or time-changing decay rates, which we don't have in our system since we have an isolated quantum system. But an interesting aspect is that one can see that for all these systems, the underlying general feature is that these distribution of the interactions is finally scale invariant, which also then leads to a scale invariant distribution of the, if you want, of the decay or interaction times. And that is something that is actually realized in our system. We can rescale our interactions in such a way that we also get a scale invariant distribution of the interaction strengths. So in this sense, we seem to have found another example of a genuine example for the emergence of stretched exponential decays, but now in an isolated system and not a system that is coupled to reservoirs. Okay, just a brief additional experiment that we did also not so long ago. It turns out that we can not only change the Hamiltonians by using different states and different couplings to these states, but it turns out that we can even engineer them actively by using techniques that go under the name of Floquet Hamiltonian engineering. What we actually do there is we start with a spin system, and then we have sequences of little field impulses that change the reference system for the local reference system for the atoms. And by doing so, we can let the system evolve under the different actions of the different parts here of this Hamiltonian through different times. Then you just close this by an echo sequence. And it turns out what you get then is fully tunable is systems like X, Y, Z Hamiltonians, where you can tune the contribution of the different terms by just tuning the times here of your pulses. So that seems to be a great thing. And one of the things that you can do is, for example, you can just let the system evolve under the action of these interactions. As I showed to you, you get this kind of relaxation, but then you would suddenly turn on another Hamiltonian, which is totally symmetric. And at this moment, the dynamics is stalled. So you can prepare a complicated initial state just by letting the system evolve under its own interactions. And suddenly the system, the dynamics is totally stalled because you go to a new Hamiltonian. And recently we have done that together with Antoine in his lab, now not using disordered samples, but here nicely 2D lattices. And again, here, what we can do here, first we let the system not evolve, and then we, at a given moment, we change our Hamiltonian, and then we see this kind of relaxation. Okay, but now let me show to you some really very recent, experiments that turn out to be to have a direct connection to this question of whether the system reaches a thermostat or not. So instead of now letting the system evolve under just the own interactions, the interactions that are inherent in the system, we now provide the system, or we let the system interact with some, or we quench the system by having an external field that we change. So we prepare the system, and then suddenly we turn on an electric field in this language, or a transverse field, magnetic field, that is pointing in the X direction. And we map out something that you would usually, in a magnet, that would usually be, maybe I should show this first, that would usually be the hysteresis curve. So you change the field and you look at the magnetization, how it follows this external field. And maybe if we start here from this part, what you see is that the magnetization with the decreasing field goes to zero. If we had a magnet, a real magnet, it would now go negative. But since we have an isolated system, it can't get rid of its energy and its magnetization. So what it does, it actually swaps back. Although the field points in one direction, it swaps back or it stays in the opposite direction. That is what is shown here. So it is oppositely aligned to the field, this system. So how we measure this is now what we do is instead of just looking at the dephasing or demagnetization without field, that was what we just discussed before, we now have this weak field or strong field, and you can see that now the system actually emerges into a finite magnetization state here. And that is exactly this curve that I'm showing here. So this is this these blue dots. So you can see that it at zero field, it goes more or less, it equilibrates to zero, but then it goes to finite values if the field is strong enough. And if you look deeper into this region around zero here, you can see that there's this, it's really like a cusp. It's not a smooth transition here, but it's a cusp, and this cusp is also asymmetric. So now the question is, how can we understand that? What is the dynamics and what is the deeper reason why the system behaves like that, this isolated system? And as it turns out, it tells us something about whether the system is thermalized or not. So what happens actually, and that comes out now from the simulations that we can do with very few particles, is that the system undergoes, when there's this additional field and this quench, that the system undergoes some interesting dynamics where the system somehow seems to split into two subsystems. One is the system where all these individual spins are actually locked by the mean field plus this external field. So there's some kind of spin locking. So they all point in this direction. But then there's some closed pairs, since we have a distribution function of the this distances, there is some closed pairs, and these closed pairs, they are mainly driven by their mutual internal interaction, and so they start to dephase. So somehow this system seems to segregate into two subsystems. One is the subsystems where these spins actually got locked, spin locked, and then there are subsystems where there's closed pairs which dephase. And if you then add up the total magnetization, this total magnetization, if there is this field, will end at a finite value. So what is interesting, we can now compare these finite values that are reached after a longer time. We can compare them to what we would expect for a diagonal and for a microcanonical ensemble. And for a zero field, it turns out that these two values actually coincide and they are zero. Whereas if we go for this finite field, this diagonal value actually coincides from what we actually see, but it differs from a microcanonical ensemble. So in other words, due to the segregation of the system into, if you want, several parts, this system does not seem to show thermalization. So we can also look at this more from the perspective of these eigenstates that I also showed in the beginning, that this might give you a hint on whether the system can thermalize or not. What is the distribution of these eigenvalues and certain observables? Just to give you an idea here, this would be now these, six spins with this field. And I just plot here the magnetization per spin, the average magnetization per spin. And now it depends on whether there's one spin flip, two, three, and if they are all flipped, what kind of value you get for this magnetization as a function of energy. And if you now look at this interacting scenario where you have this XXZ Hamiltonian, where you also have these two sub-ensembles, the ones that are just spin locked and the ones that are actually interacting, then you can see, if you look closely on it, this is the average energy here, E0, but you can see that we have a large distribution of energy eigenvalues that is the reason why we don't see the system following this eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, because now it depends really on the subtle details of the realization whether which kind of the pairs are already have demagnetized and which spins are still behaving more or less like independent spins. What is, or what was, I should say, positively surprising to us was that this simple measurement, this really the most simple measurement that you can do on this system, measuring the magnetization as a function of an external field, that this gives you a direct way to distinguish between whether you have a thermalized or whether you have a just a diagonal ensemble. This is here for these repulsive interactions. It turns out that this curve here, this magnetization versus a field curve for just a diagonal ensemble, shows a non-analytical behavior at zero, where we have the symmetry changing point, symmetry breaking point. We have only positive magnetization as it comes out, and we have this asymmetry. Whereas if we do the same calculation now for a microcanonical ensemble, we find that now this magnetization curve as a function of field is actually smooth. It can eventually become negative, and the asymmetry is actually getting smaller. And this is now a nice thing, because now we can use this very, very simple measurement, this really the most simple measurement that you could think of, magnetization as a function of field, we can use to determine whether our system has reached a thermal or just a situation where it became diagonal without having a need of any access to local variables. And as you can see here clearly, we see this cusp, we see the asymmetry, and if we take all this together, what we see in the experiment is indeed that the system is diagonal, but it's not thermalized. So it violates this eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, although the system is non-integrable in its nature. So why we consider this interesting? Because like always, I mean, we can compare numerics, which we can calculate up to 14 particles, now with an experiment that has a huge number, I mean 3,000, but it has a large number where we can already, to a certain extent, hope that we reach something like a thermodynamic limit or so. Yet, of course, we are still measuring at finite times. I mean, we can't go and wait forever. We have to wait for something like 10 to 20 inverse interaction times. That's the longest we can wait until other effects drop in our system that might lead to decoherence and stuff like that. But nevertheless, so the final conclusion that we reached, and this gets me to the end, is that this isolated disordered Heisenberg spin system, so if you want one of the simplest models that you can have for systems, introducing the simplest possible symmetry breaking by applying a transverse field, it does not thermalize, and it violates ETH despite the fact that it's non-integrable. But what is even more interesting, we have some recent data that this thermalization actually is restored at the moment we either change for another interaction, one over R3, or we make the system become more ordered. In this case, the segregation of pairs and single atoms is no longer relevant. And the system starts to actually follow this, and that's what we see in our data as well, follows this smooth dependence of the magnetization on the external field. All right, so what I've shown to you is that these Rydberg systems are really interesting systems to study non-trivial Hamiltonians, in our case, Heisenberg Hamiltonians. I showed to you that if you isolate such a system, it relaxes in some kind of universal way, meaning that it doesn't depend on the initial conditions sensitively. And although it's non-integrable, it does not thermalize. All right, let me give credit. This work is done by a group of people, but mainly I would here like to emphasize here Titus Franz, who's about to finish his thesis, Clément, a postdoc, who now went back on a position in Lille, Sebastian, a PhD student on the system, Adrien was involved in the early days, he joined Pascal, and Martin, he is a theorist here in Heidelberg, working together with us on the interpretation of these phenomena. Okay, this is Heidelberg seen from a Neckar bridge. And with this, I would like to thank you for your attention. And I wish I could be in this lecture hall and enjoy Paris. All right, thank you.